This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 268 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the FanDuel Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Since a lot of you are drafting this weekend, make sure to check out the NumberFire Draft Kit before you do so. In it, you'll have access to expert rankings from yours truly, but then there are auction values from the NumberFire algorithm, defensive matchup data, and lots more. And you can customize the draft kit to fit your league settings to make sure that you're getting the most accurate projections and rankings possible. Late Round Podcast listeners can use the promo code CHAMPION to get your first month of premium for just $9.99. That's promo code CHAMPION. Start your journey to a fantasy football championship today. Now let's get to the mailbag questions. This first mailbag question is an email that says, I went all in on my team at the trade deadline last year, and this year, I'm drafting without my second and fourth round picks. When in a situation like this, how should I adjust my draft strategy? Should I swing for the fences and focus on upside, or target safer picks early and hope a late round flyer pans out? Dominic in Jersey. I don't think there's an easy answer to this, especially since I don't know what the scoring settings and league settings are. But I may just go with more of a zero RB type approach, since later round running backs are more likely to pop than later round wide receivers are. That's what we've seen historically. That historic data also makes sense because if an injury happens, we know backup running backs are set to see more volume. At wide receiver, those targets get distributed throughout the team, not just to one or two guys. It depends on what's there when you're drafting, though. Like, don't pass up on Saquon Barkley for a wide receiver just because it makes more sense to go wide receiver given your lack of draft picks. Your goal is to still be optimal, but strategically, it does make some sense to lean wide receiver if this is a normal PPR-type format. This next question is from @burleyboy77. You loved Nyheim Hines last season. Good offense, pass-catching back. Where's the love for him this time around? Yeah, I did like Nyheim Hines last year with a lot of the uncertainty in that Colts backfield and Marlon Mack entering the year with an injury. Process-wise, it made a lot of sense. I was into him as a prospect, too. But we now have a full season of seeing how the Colts' backfield operates with a healthy Marlon Mack. And that's why I'm not going as hard with Nyheim Hines this year. Last season, without Marlon Mack in the lineup, so a four-game sample, Hines saw 9, 5, 11, and 9 targets. Three of those games were his highest targeted games of the season. And three of those games were also the highest snap shares of his season. He hit 45% of Indianapolis' snaps in 5 games last year, and 4 of them came when Marlon Mack wasn't playing. The other game happened in week 13 when the Colts were shut out against Jacksonville. And that's the key here with Nyheim Hines. He's a negative game script player. Not only is that going to be somewhat difficult to predict each week, but if Andrew Luck is healthy, the Colts are likely to be pretty good. They won't see those negative game scripts as often. And then there's also more competition on that team, specifically Paris Campbell. Campbell could play snaps from the slot and steal a lot of those underneath looks, and that will lower the target ceiling for Nyheim Hines. When Paris Campbell was drafted by Indy, one of my first reactions was actually that it low-key hurt Nyheim Hines. So I don't mind Hines in best ball necessarily or as a player himself. I like Nyheim Hines as a player. I think he's the right type of back for today's NFL. I just worry about him having a real ceiling in fantasy football. This next question says, JJ, love your pod. Thanks. I'm frustrated with the term vacated targets. You hear this all the time on fantasy football podcasts. The best example is Antonio Brown. I keep hearing about his 169 nice vacated targets that have to go to someone, but I don't believe the Steelers will throw the ball the same number of times this year. If you look at data from the past few years, you'll notice that Pittsburgh threw the ball 61.7% of the time, 58.9% of the time, and 59.7% of the time in 2015, 16, and 17 respectively, before 2018 when they threw it 67.4% of the time. This feels like an obvious season for regression. When you build projections, what do you look at when projecting pass attempts and overall plays per game, especially when you are dealing with teams with new head coaches and or coordinators? Sorry for the long-winded question, Nick. Yeah, so if you listen back to my team-level regression podcast, which is episode 252, I talked about Pittsburgh and their high pass-to-rush attempt ratio last year. Essentially, teams with that high of a ratio see it decline the following year. So you're right, it's highly unlikely that the Steelers will have the same type of volume this year in the passing game. And I'm glad that you brought up projections here, because projections show all of this. Instead of vacated targets, it's projected targets. I don't think vacated targets are a horrible thing to quickly reference to get a point across, but there are going to be instances where talking about vacated targets won't give you a very accurate projection. So the question becomes, like you said, what are we looking at when projecting pass attempts and plays per game? And the answer to that is that it's a combination of a lot of things. It's recent history, it's offensive play caller tendencies, it's looking at regression, it's looking at what teams did in neutral game scripts, and it's looking at things like over-under win totals to see how good teams are projected to be the following season. Because teams who trailed a lot the previous year who are projected to be better in the following season aren't going to throw the ball as much as they did the year prior. More positive game scripts means more running. So there's not just one or two things. It's a lot of things to get that projected ratio and plays run per game number. But this is definitely the right way to think about everything instead of simply looking at vacated targets. This next question is from @MikeSandman62. With Damian Williams back taking most of the running back reps with the ones now, do you buy Reed's RBBC claim? Is Williams back to near bell cow status, or is he just getting more reps now because he missed time and needs to catch up? So last week, Andy Reid said that his backfield would be, quote, kind of a running back by committee, and we have some success with it. We'll do that here. We've got a couple of Williamses, and then Carlos, and then we've got a new little guy in there who's Darwin Thompson. And they all have their strengths, and we'll try to exploit their strengths there. That's what Andy Reid said. Meanwhile, a month prior to that quote, Andy Reid said, quote, we are asking him, Damian Williams, to be the full-time starter. He's taken the challenge and earned the right to be that guy. Now it's a matter of production. Go do it. So back in July, Andy Reid was saying that Damian Williams was the guy. A month later, he's saying there's going to be a committee. What happened in between? I'll tell you what happened. A hamstring injury happened. Is it possible that the hamstring injury that Damian Williams had allowed the Chiefs to see what they had in their other running backs and they liked what they saw? Absolutely. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. And I think any player who's dealing with some sort of injury has a chance to be knocked down in rankings entering the season. But at the same time, what else is Andy Reid going to say in this scenario? That all of those other running backs don't matter and that it's going to be the Damian Williams show? We have a history of top Andy Reid running backs seeing pretty good workloads. Williams was the clear top back according to everything we heard in July. He gets hurt, we see other running backs, now it's a committee, but Williams is seeing first team reps again. So I still have Williams as a solid RB2 right now. Now, I wasn't buying him much where he was being drafted pre-injury because the opportunity cost was higher given the wide receivers that are selected in the mid and late second round. It was hard to draft Damian Williams ahead of Mike Evans. And over the last week on draft, he's still a late second rounder. And that's probably still a little bit too high for me. I like Kerryon Johnson ahead of Damian Williams right now, for instance. But I think Williams' price still does make sense. And if I'm throwing a dart later, it's with Darwin Thompson, who looks like he could be a Tariq Cohen type player in that offense. And that's precisely the kind of player who fits that offense. This next question from Twitter put me on tilt. It says, can we just admit that Aaron Jones is Kenyon Drake North? Yeah, Aaron Jones is exactly like Kenyon Drake North, except he's good. You guys know that I prospect with data and look at production when evaluating these running backs and receivers. And the reason I was so into Aaron Jones when he was entering the league was because his production was amazing. Like across the board, whether you're looking at rushing or receiving. Kenyon Drake had a college dominator rating that ranked in the 13th percentile. He had 233 rush attempts throughout college. Aaron Jones had 242 rush attempts during his sophomore season. You can talk about the programs that they went to and all that, but you can also adjust for those things. When a player like Kenyon Drake is consistently not the starter for his own team, you have to ask questions. And I don't really mind Kenyon Drake the player either. You know, injury aside, that's going on right now. I'm just saying, in comparison to Aaron Jones, it's no contest. I'm done tilting now. This next question is from Twitter. It says, how do you incorporate O-line ranks into your running back ranks? Nick Chubb comes to mind. Things seem to be pointing up given his immense talent, the Duke trade, and positive changes to the offense. But his offensive line is very weak, and it is not being discussed. Should this matter on draft day? So let's get a little philosophical here. First and foremost, the question we should ask is, how important is offensive line play itself for running backs in fantasy football? We know offensive line play matters for running back production. But to what degree? And then to that point, even if we know that offensive line play matters a lot for running backs, do we know if offensive line play is predictable? Are we good at predicting which lines will be really good and really bad? And then again, how does this precisely relate to fantasy football? What we know about fantasy football is that volume drives the game. And volume doesn't really have anything to do with offensive line play, aside from the fact that a good offensive line can help an offense, which can help extend drives and create more plays. But other things impact that as well. Good quarterback play, good wide receiver play, good play calling, fast-paced play calling. All of those things impact volume, arguably more than what an offensive line would. So if offensive lines aren't really impacting volume that much, then we know that they're probably a little overstated and overrated in fantasy football evaluation. But then on top of that, like I just said, we don't even know if offensive line play is predictive. We can sit back and say that the Browns will have a bad offensive line this year, but we don't even know if that's going to come to fruition. And given the complexities in measuring something like O-line performance, you're going to have a good bit of variance in those projections. Now, I'm not saying that we just ignore offensive line. That would be stupid. What you can probably do is just manually bump down a player's yards per carry average if you're not feeling great about that offensive line. That's to just put it really simplistically. But efficiency doesn't move the needle all that much, especially if you're not drastically changing that efficiency. I'd also argue that you're only going to see huge changes at the extremes. If there's an objectively horrific offensive line, then that's really the only time that you should put a ton of emphasis on that offensive line play when you're choosing your running back. We have all these little inputs that go into how we project a player. Offensive line play is certainly one of them. But too often, we take one of those small inputs and we make too big of a deal out of it. Like if everything else is there for Nick Chubb and he has a bad or below average offensive line, that shouldn't really change your overall opinion on Nick Chubb. What's more important for Chubb is his pass catching ceiling and what happens when Kareem Hunt comes back. Volume is what's important for Nick Chubb. Now, I don't want this answer to be twisted. You want good offensive lines for your running backs. But volume will always be king, and there are other pieces to an offense that can help with that volume equation. This is really about emphasizing what's most important in order to become a better decision maker. This next question says, JJ, in my 14-team home league with standard scoring, each team keeps three players with no keeper costs. It's an auction draft. Given my relatively weak other keeper options, I am definitely keeping Melvin Gordon. I've heard other fantasy analysts say that generally, if you draft Gordon, then you have to pair him with Eckler and or Jackson as insurance. But I think instead I would be better off ignoring Eckler and Jackson, unless their value is insanely good, and then focus on potential breakout running backs on other teams. Seems to make sense if my goal is to win, rather than finish in fourth place. Thoughts on this from a strategy perspective? Thanks, Andy in San Diego. Yeah, this is an argument that I've used against handcuffing for a while now. Not only is handcuffing generally not a good draft strategy, but one that you should tackle later in the season, but technically, if you want upside, then you should draft handcuffs for running backs that you don't have. For example, if you don't have David Johnson, and if you're in a deep league where you can stash handcuffs, then draft Chase Edmonds. All of a sudden, if David Johnson goes down, you have a very viable fantasy option. And that fantasy option is on top of what you already have, which doesn't include David Johnson. So it's a safety versus upside thing. Most people would rather go the route of safety. And I can definitely understand that when we're talking about players who are holding out. But it's also totally fine and smart to think the way that you're thinking, Andy. This next question says, hey JJ, big fan and love your work. Thank you. Is there any data or evidence to support stacking a running back or a wide receiver, or tight end for this matter, from the same team in season-long redrafts? Thinking it could be effective in a high-flying offense like the Packers with Aaron Jones and Devontae Adams. Hope to hear your answer on the pod. Thanks. Justin Rose, not the English professional golfer. So I admittedly haven't done a study on this. So maybe next offseason I'll try to. But my general rule of thumb is that you first need to be optimal with your draft choice. As in, don't force or avoid a stack if that means that you're being suboptimal. And that stack is also going to be a lot easier to utilize if it's in an objectively good offense, like Green Bay, as you mentioned. I would likely try to avoid getting multiple early round players from average to below average offenses. But it's fine if you get like Devontae Freeman and Julio Jones. Just make sure that you're not doing it just to do it. But I do get this question all the time, so I figured that I'd share some thoughts. This last question is from @YanceyEaton on Twitter. Is there some viability to Jalen Hurd as a late round dart throw with Trent Taylor going down and the early ineffectiveness of Dante Pettis? Yeah, so I liked Jalen Hurd as a straight up athlete entering the draft. It's kind of hard not to. But I really viewed him as someone who would be the Swiss Army knife type player for Kyle Shanahan, not really a high volume player. But this Trent Taylor injury has at least opened the door for Hurd to take on the slot role for San Francisco. According to Pro Football Focus, Hurd played the second most snaps from the slot last year among relevant college wide receivers. If there is a higher volume role in the NFL for him, it's as a slot guy. So yes, count me in as someone who thinks that Hurd has become an intriguing late round dart throw. And regarding Dante Pettis, the reports on him have been all over the place, similar to Damian Williams. He may be having a bad camp, that's fine. But throughout the offseason, the 49ers were saying nothing but positive things about him. How he was incredibly talented and their top guy. And I thought this was an interesting and probably accurate statement that came out yesterday from Matt Barrows of The Athletic. He said, quote, "Shanahan feels Pettis is talented enough to be a great wide receiver and wants to put pressure on him to reach that status." That would explain all of the "he hasn't won the starting job" critiquing that's been going on around Dante Pettis. If you listen to this show regularly, then you know that I'm just generally into this offense because all of the pieces are very fairly priced. Pettis went from being undervalued this offseason to being correctly valued, but if this news makes his ADP drop dramatically, then I'll be buying Dante Pettis once again. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all of you guys for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it pretty much anywhere podcasts can be found. And wherever you listen to the show, please do me a favor and leave a rating and review, preferably on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Also, guys, I hate that I have to do this every year. I really, really do. And I apologize for sounding like an ass when I say this. But just as a reminder, the email address of jj@numberfire.com that's out there, it's there so I can field deeper questions for this mailbag episode. I try to get back to everyone who emails me, but the expectation just can't be that you send me 2,000 words about your keeper league situation and then I answer that question. I just have to be realistic. I only have so much time in a day. I want to help you guys out as much as possible, but if I were to open up the email to any and all fantasy questions, I wouldn't be able to get my job done. I'm just being realistic. So I just ask that you treat the email address as a place to submit mailbag questions only. It allows for a lot less awkwardness when I respond and say, "Hey, I would love to help, but can you make this 300 words instead of 3,000? Again, I really do hate having to talk about this on the show. It makes me feel really uncomfortable, as you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, and it makes me assume that you guys think that I'm just being a jerk. But it's that I don't want to disappoint any of you if I can't get back to you, since the question itself is just so in-depth. And you know that if you have fantasy questions, I'm always on Twitter, and I'll be doing things like Facebook Lives throughout the fantasy season. So thanks for understanding. I hope it all makes sense. And thanks so much for listening to today's show. It's always, always appreciated. Hope you have an awesome weekend, and I hope you crush your fantasy football drafts.